Mr. President, essentially we're up against a wall.
The Senate looks at health insurance. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, Southeast Alaska Native communities could get more land.
So it would have a tremendous impact on the region and on the economy of the whole Southeast Panhandle.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Governor Bill Walker has declared today Dutch Harbor Remembrance Day. Statewide, all flags will fly at half-mast to recognize Japan's World War II attack on Dutch Harbor. The 1942 bombing was the first hostile action on Alaskan soil. 25 service members were killed. Dutch Harbor was attacked again later in the war, as were the communities of Adak, Kiska, and Attu. In response to the June 3rd strike, the United States forced Unungan people to move to internment camps in southeast Alaska, where they suffered from disease and malnutrition. Many were never able to return to their original villages. Governor Walker hopes Dutch Harbor Remembrance Day will honor the military who served and died defending the United States and the Unungan people who died while interned. The Senate voted 15-2 today to pass a bill to lower health insurance premium increases for individuals and families. State Insurance Division Director Lori Wing Heyer told lawmakers last week that the individual insurance market could collapse if the legislature does not pass the bill. The Anchorage Republican, Senator Mia Costello, supports the bill and notes that insurance costs now exceed many families' mortgage payments.
Through this legislation, we're addressing a crisis. Mr. President, essentially, we're up against a wall.
The bill provides $55 million to fund a reinsurance program. This will offset the costs for Alaskans with the highest health care payments. Premier Alaska will be the only insurer on the individual market. Moda Health said it would stop offering individual plans by the end of the year. Wing Heyer says there are many reasons why Alaska has high health care costs.
There's a lot of duplication in equipment in Alaska, and there's also no mechanism to control fees in the private industry and physicians. And those are things that we need to work on.
The House could vote on the bill as soon as tomorrow. The University of Alaska Board of Regents has adopted the system's nearly $910 million operating budget for the upcoming fiscal year. Just under $335 million of that comes from the state. That means the university system faces a $40 million budget shortfall. That's much less than the $75 million discussed previously. Jim Johnson is University of Alaska president.
That's a big difference. So that enables us really to continue investing in some programs. We're still going to have to reduce programs. We're going to have to reduce people, unfortunately. But this enables us to have a glide path to the future where we can be much more careful about the reductions we make. And it enables us to invest strategically in really high value areas, areas that meet the state's higher education needs.
It's not immediately clear how many jobs will be impacted, but it's expected to be fewer than the 700-plus positions anticipated under the larger cut. The board approved the operating budget by a vote of 10-1, with Regent Kenneth Fisher tallying the no vote. The state's capital appropriation for the university only includes $19 million reallocated from the municipality of Anchorage for the controversial UMed Road. Since the university did not receive funding for the partially built engineering building on the Fairbanks campus, the Board of Regents at a future meeting will explore the development of a $40 million bonding package to complete construction. Alaska State Troopers shot a man wielding a knife Thursday evening in Wasilla. Troopers responded to the incident just after 7:20 p.m. and encountered 33-year-old Joshua Smith. According to a trooper dispatch, while officers were talking with the man, he charged at them, knife in hand. Two troopers fired their service weapons, and a third attempted to use a taser. Smith suffered multiple gunshot wounds and was transported to an Anchorage hospital, where he died this morning. No troopers were injured in the incident. The two who fired their weapons have been placed on administrative leave for 72 hours per department policy. The Alaska Bureau of Investigations is investigating the incident. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Have Cello Will Travel.
Did you know that Mr. Johansson is kind of a rock star?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The Bureau of Land Management continues to work on cleaning up the debris from decades-old experimental oil drills on Alaska's North Slope. BLM had set an ambitious agenda for work this past winter, but only completed cleanup for 10 wells. They planned on 14. BLM's Legacy Wells Project Coordinator Nicole Hayes said Friday that the highest priority wells are located at Umanat, Barrow, and Cape Simpson.
The reason why these were identified as being the highest priority wells were basically the risk to the environment, the surface and the subsurface risks, as well as our opportunity to identify and work on clusters of wells at a time.
BLM received $50 million in 2013 from the Federal Helium Act to clean up the wells. Hayes says this winter, six wells were successfully plugged and abandoned, and four wellheads were removed at the Cape Simpson cluster. But an attempt to clean up one of four wells tapped for remediation in Barrow was not successful.
The winter tundra travel closure season came really quickly, and so we had to move quickly to demobilize. And so the decision was made that we would just close in the Ico Bay well for the winter. The Ico Bay well is the one known as the Whistlin' well. The good news was they were able to put another wellhead on top of it, and that one's secured, so there's no methane leaking into the environment. However, that well is not complete, and we will have to go back and reassess how we're going to move forward.
He says BLM is working with the state and contractors to make a plan to successfully plug the Barrow wells next winter. Marsh Creek and Aludic are the two contractors doing the work. In May, Senator Lisa Murkowski sent a letter to the Interior Secretary, Sally Jewell, asking for information about the cleanup. Murkowski chairs the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and mentioned reports of safety violations and missteps during the cleanup work. Hayes said she had not received any specific concerns from Barrow residents concerning the cleanup. In April, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission sent the agency notice that it had violated state regulations in some of its work on the legacy wells. Hayes says there are still $15 million to cover work on about three more wells, and the BLM is working with AOGCC on the cleanup. AOGCC Chair Kathy Forrester was not available for comment today. A U.S. Senate bill introduced last week would allow Alaska Natives in five Southeast communities to form urban corporations. Haines, Ketchikan, Petersburg, Tenakee, and Wrangell each stand to gain about 23,000 acres of land. As KSTK's Aaron Bolton reports, a prominent conservation organization is opposing the bill.
In 1971, more than 200 Native corporations formed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, known as ANCSA, but Haines, Ketchikan, Petersburg, Tenakee, and Wrangell were left out of the landmark legislation. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Improvement Act was introduced May 26 by Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan and could award those landless Native groups 23,040 acres of land each. Leo Barlow represents both the Southeast and Wrangell Landless Coalitions. He says while many natives in these communities have benefited from Southeast Regional Native Corporation, Sea Alaska, which pays dividends and creates jobs, but he says they lack the benefits provided by a local corporation.
You know, other village corporations in the region that have achieved such a settlement have done a lot of things with their lands. They've been able to do a lot of economic activities to the benefit of their shareholders, start businesses and things like ecotourism, hotels. A lot have relied on resource development on the land as a means of providing economic income.
If passed, the Improvement Act would allow the five corporations to pick land of historic, cultural, and commercial value, but would not allow conservation lands to be awarded. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, or SEAC, is opposing the bill. Spokeswoman Emily Ferry says the group is concerned about the commercial activity.
And we don't know how they would be managed. The public doesn't have very much input into the process. The lands would be selected by the Native corporations, these new Native corporations, and the Secretary of the Interior. And as we know from the past, that lands that were transferred to Native corporations, at least previously, were heavily logged.
Ferry says SEAC called upon Senator Murkowski to include the general public by holding hearings on the issue. SEAC would also like more environmental protection, particularly forest preservation, added to the bill.
And we would really like to see a dialogue about how that could happen. That's in part why we're calling on Senator Murkowski to come to Southeast Alaska to open up a dialogue, to hold hearings, to talk with communities, both the people who would benefit from this proposed legislation and the communities who rely on our public land.
Senator Murkowski's office did not respond to requests for comment or information. The local corporations would have surface rights that would allow logging and other surface-based economic activity, but Barlow says he doesn't expect any excessive clear-cutting.
You know, obviously there are timber resources that could be harvested, and the whole goal would be to do that on a sustainable basis, not like the old days when, you know, there were large, extensive clear-cuts all across the Tongass and Southeast Alaska.
Barlow says the corporations could also focus on eco and cultural tourism to bring in money, and says he thinks natives would not be the only ones to see the benefits.
It actually benefits the entire community, as you can see throughout Southeast Alaska, that a lot of the employment created by other village corporations in the region goes to natives and non-natives alike. So it would have a tremendous impact on the region and on the economy of the whole Southeast Panhandle.
The ANCSA Improvement Bill is not the first legislative attempt at providing landless communities corporate status. The current version combines several Senate and House bills from decades past. Another section of the bill would allow Sea Alaska to exchange 23,000 acres of land on Admiralty Island for about 14,000 acres of more commercially viable land, and could also award Native Vietnam veterans land as well. SEAC spokeswoman Emily Ferry says the conservation group will wait for Senator Murkowski's response before stepping up efforts to oppose the bill. Both Senator Murkowski and Sullivan were unavailable for comment for the story. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
There's still no official word from authorities as to the identities of the victims of the fire yesterday morning at a remote Kodiak Island lodge. The fire claimed one life and injured three. State Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says troopers made it to the site late Thursday evening and are still working to identify the victim. The blaze broke out around 4 a.m. at the Spirit of Alaska Wilderness Adventures Lodge in Uyak Bay, about 60 miles southwest of Kodiak City. Alaska State Troopers were unable to fly to the lodge Thursday because of poor visibility. As a result of their delay, the cause of the fire is also unknown. But judging from photos from the U.S. Coast Guard taken from a mid-morning overflight, it appears the lodge's bunkhouse was consumed. According to the company's website, it held four bedrooms and a kitchen. The lodge is the former park's cannery, which closed in 1983. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is considering a state-sought permit to apply an herbicide to three Fairbanks area water bodies infested with the invasive plant Elodia. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, fluoridone has proven successful.
The interior waters targeted for fluoridone application are Chena Lakes in Slough in North Pole and Tochacket Slough north of Nenana. Department of Environmental Conservation Pesticide Control Program Director Karin Hendrickson says the herbicide has been successfully employed against similar Elodia infestations in Anchorage, Kenai, and Cordova.
It's an herbicide that basically works by preventing the plants from photosynthesizing.
Hendrickson says the main risk in using the herbicide is killing off non-target native plants.
So you want to make sure that it's applied carefully with a mind to that. You know, it's pretty widely studied in terms of any impacts on other animals or humans or drinking water.
Hendrickson says a risk assessment will be conducted specific to the herbicide application permit requested by the Department of Natural Resources.
The ultimate goal is for statewide eradication of Elodia.
DNR invasive plant coordinator Heather Stewart says it's suspected that Elodia came to Alaska as an aquarium plant. Stewart says Elodia spreads easily as small bits of the plant can reroute after being accidentally transported on boats, float planes, fishing, and other water sports gear.
If we don't deal with it on a statewide level, then there's always that risk of having a water body that hasn't been dealt with Elodia in it, reinfesting an area that has already been treated.
A fragment of the plant can start a new population.
Aditi Shenoy is with the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District, which has been wrestling with the local Elodia infestation for a decade.
Assessed a number of different alternatives for controlling Elodia. Mechanical control using a suction dredge combined with raking.
The harvesting technique proved unsuccessful against Elodia, and the focus shifted to herbicide. Depending on the DEC risk assessment and permit, Shenoy says application of fluoridone could occur as early as this summer, noting there's some urgency given the threat posed by Elodia.
Could ruin fish habitat, which is really important for salmon and grayling rearing and spawning. And also, if it gets into float planes and things, it creates really hazardous conditions for float plane operation.
Shenoy says she's applying for grants to help fund the project. The cost of fluoridone to treat Fairbanks area waters is estimated at close to $1 million. Federal agencies like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service help fund Alaska Elodia eradication projects. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A new study co-authored by two UAF researchers suggests that, contrary to previous studies, Alaska's wildfires and thawing permafrost may not generate more carbon than its ecosystems can capture, at least through the end of the century. That's potentially positive short-term news, but the study that David McGuire and Scott Rupp advises that Alaska could still become a net producer of carbon if temperatures increases, permafrost thaw, and wildfire frequency and intensity are much greater than the study anticipates. That in turn could lead to a greater concentration of atmospheric greenhouse gases and more warming, an ongoing process climate scientists call a feedback loop. McGuire with UAF's Institute for Arctic Biology and Rupp, director of UAF's Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning, worked with other researchers from the U.S. Geological Survey and Forest Service on the study. Four new fires have been reported today, two of them human-caused. A house fire in Delta threatened wildlands, but was contained and is out. A Palmer fire erupted when a homeowner set fire to an old chicken coop. Fire responders issued a warning after dousing the flames. Two lightning-sparked fires continued to burn. The Big Mud fire, southwest of Tanana, had consumed 300 acres so far. BLM fire crews are monitoring that blaze. And the Arrowpuck fire on federal land in the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge has covered 20 acres and is in monitor status.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Cello Walk. Walk to Fisterra is a new documentary showing tonight in Fairbanks. It features Alaskan-born cellist Dane Johansson walking more than 500 miles with his cello on his back and playing the Bach cello suites along the Spanish pilgrimage to Camino de Santiago. He's the son of Gail Johansson, who is the music director for the Fairbanks Suzuki Institute, so learning a string instrument was almost a given. Dane picked up the cello when he was just 4. As he grew in talent and stature, so did the size of his cello, which made for an interesting trip as he trekked with thousands of other pilgrims on the walk to Fisterra. KUAC's Lori Neufeld reports.
Carrying the cello for almost 600 miles was actually not as much of a challenge as Johansson thought it was going to be.
The size of it and the shape of the case made it a little bit more challenging than a backpack would have been, in that it wasn't really tight to my back. You know, it was blowing in the wind a little more freely than a backpack might. But overall, the experience was not physically so difficult. I was actually probably under the same amount of weight as anyone else walking that route with a fairly well-packed backpack.
Johansson describes himself as a Fairbanks kid and loves the outdoors and spending time in nature.
I always kind of felt this pull in two different directions between music and my love for playing the cello and adventure and the outdoors and all the things I like to do away from music, that I couldn't ever find a way to put those two things together.
Then this project helped him do that.
So that was a really nice thing to finally realize, combining those two different areas of my life.
The pilgrimage from the Great Pyrenees in the south of France across Spain to the most northwestern corner of Spain took Johansson and his documentary film crew 40 days. Johansson performed 36 evenings along the journey at different venues, from town squares to ancient churches. Every performance included at least 3 of the 6 Bach suites for solo cello. The inspiration for the adventure developed over time.
It was inspired by a friend of mine, a composer who had walked the Appalachian Trail here in the United States, and he had written 81 movements for string quartet along the way about his experience on the Appalachian Trail.
Johansson got really inspired and thought he could do something like that, maybe with his cello. He got started looking for a venue, a place to do that, and he knew the Appalachian Trail wasn't going to work because there's just not that many people on it.
So I needed a place with a lot of people, a lot of traffic. So I found the Camino de Santiago, and it seemed like a good fit for this idea of carrying my cello and the music of Bach with me. And then it kind of snowballed from there. You know, I told a friend of mine about it who's an audio engineer, and he said, oh, well, you have to record the music in all those churches along the way. And I thought, okay, I could probably figure out how to do that. And then a filmmaker friend of mine said, well, you know, you should really think about making a documentary film about it.
It happens to be the documentary film showing in Fairbanks that drew Johansson up here this week. And he follows in Gail Johansson's footsteps and, just like his mom, teaches at the Fairbanks Suzuki Institute.
Okay, listen to yourself as a member of an ensemble, as a working part of this machine.
Did you know that Mr. Johansson is kind of a rock star?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally.
How did you know that he is kind of a big deal?
Well, his teacher, or my teacher, is his mom. So hearing about him all the time in our lessons, and I've known him for a long time.
One last time, all the right notes. Good. Good. It's getting better. We'll keep working on it tomorrow.
I do love coming back to this community whenever I get a chance. It's just home, and the people are wonderful, and I don't find people like this everywhere in the world. So it's really special to come back and get to experience this beautiful place.
Thane Johansson's Walk to Fisterra shows at UAF's Davis Concert Hall at 7 tonight in Fairbanks. For AK, I'm Lori Neufeld.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Grant Dusing in Anchorage. Dusing is a graphic designer and a student worker at UAA.
My father was a principal that moved around often. I've lived in Galena, Nanwalek, Anchor Point, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Anderson, Juneau. I also lived up in the bush in like Noatak and Norvik. The state nickname itself, the last frontier, you know, I really like the fact that we haven't become super populated with humans yet, so it's a very nice place. I mean, I really want to keep it that way. Anchorage is the hub right now, so I'm kind of like living in the city, but if I had money and a place of my own, I'd probably live out in the middle of nowhere and just, you know, be a hippie living off the land, sustaining myself. When I lived up in the bush in Noatak, I decided to go on a week-long kayak trip with my father, well above the Arctic Circle, so the middle of nowhere. We landed on a riverbed, and right when we landed, there was a bear. And I was probably 10 or 11 at the time, and this bear bluff charged me and my father, and there's one other guy, my dad's friend. So it's three people in the middle of nowhere, and we're getting bluff charged by a bear the minute we land. So that was a reality check to only in Alaska would you see this much wildlife and get charged by a bear. I've lived in cities and I've been around big cities like New York City, Philadelphia, areas like that. It just gets so congested with people. It really takes away from the environment. And I just don't want Alaska to become, you know, just a memory.
Grant Dusing lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lori Neufeld and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Aaron Bolton in Wrangell, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Alan Lockyer, Josh Edge, and Graylin Brashear in Anchorage, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media. And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering. Over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.